When you read poet A.F. Moritz's work, you have the feeling of looking down into a great and mysterious ocean teeming with life. His poetry has extraordinary depth and range. His subjects include the denizens of all-night cafes, the natural history of words, sardines on crackers, mortality, of course, ancient myths, and the ruins of abandoned factories. The Pulitzer Prize-winning American poet John Ashbery once wrote, quote, "An ancient voice, mournful like the wind, speaks to itself, yet means to be overheard in A.F. Moritz's amazing poems," end quote. His writing burns with radical energy. In fact, someone once called his poetry a word furnace. It is a call to arms to challenge the false foundations of our modern society. Other poems speak eloquently and gently about the unsung moments of urban life, like the quiet, solitary beauty of a man walking alone while a city of 3 million sleeps, or how a crowd of angry passengers can improbably improve the poetry of the bus upon boarding. His recent book, The Sparrow, pulls together poems from a distinguished career that has spanned more than 45 years and 15 books. In that time, he has won the Griffin Poetry Prize. He's been a finalist for the Governor General's Literary Award 3 times and has received a Guggenheim Fellowship. He is currently serving as Toronto's Poet Laureate. His most recent publication is a chapbook called The Art of Surgery. He holds a doctorate in 18th and 19th century British poetry, and he teaches at the University of Toronto. A.F. Moritz joins me now in our studio in Toronto. Welcome to the Sunday edition.
Hello, Michael.
Why did you call the book The Sparrow? I know there's a poem, Death of a Sparrow, but why Sparrow?
I think that there's several poems in the book that have sparrows as important figures in it. There's even a poem that didn't get into the book in which I talked to myself about, hey, why are there sparrows everywhere all the time in my poems? And I talked to the sparrows. I think that I've identified a lot with the sparrow.
Why is that?
Well, it seems to be a denizen of the city who manages to survive as a little element of nature and a little element of beauty in the little cracks and interstices that human beings leave. And like the remainders of nature, which are almost all we have in most cities, you know, raccoons and pigeons and so on, people don't even appreciate them or say thank you for at least you still exist as a natural factor in my environment. They hate them and find them lice-ridden and so forth.
Are they survivors like cockroaches or raccoons?
You could say that that's true. It may be that they even flourish in symbiosis with man. We know, for instance, that people used to say apocalyptically that the cockroach is going to outlive man and overrun the planet, and the same with rats, but that's not true at all. Rats and cockroaches' population is encouraged by the warmth we create and all the garbage we spread. Once we're gone, they will return to a normal proportion in the remaining environment.
I thought initially, and fleetingly, I got to add, that it was something to do with God notices the death of a sparrow or something, whatever that phrase is.
There's many things that you can look back in tradition about sparrows, or you could just say assimilate them to the small bird. But the importance of the sparrow in several of my poems, there's especially one in there that's just called Love Song, in which the loved one is made equivalent to a sparrow, which comes and lands on your table in a cafe and tries to get a crumb, and it manages to survive and find its way despite the fact that people are swatting at it and ignoring it and so forth. And this seems to me an emblem of the way the sensitive person has to survive in modern society.
Did you really, in grade 3, see yourself becoming a poet?
Yes, I did.
Grade 3, year 7?
I think one's about 8 or 9. But what happened to me is I'm not one of those persons who was a precocious reader and that I had a sibling who taught me before school started or anything like that. But for some reason, as soon as first grade started, I learned to read really well, really fast. And I was reading adult books by Christmas time. And so, you know, like a lot of kids, I got fascinated with the stories of King Arthur and the tale of Troy, you know, the Greek myths. And I thought I would write something like that. I already wanted to be a writer. And I was reading Edgar Allan Poe in the third grade, and I just had a little book with some of his stories, and I wanted to find more Edgar Allan Poe. So I went to the library, and I found there a big multi-volume work, and in the end of it, it had his poetry. You know, like you start at the end of the newspaper and read the funnies. I opened to the end of the book, and I started reading his poems.
Like Annabel Lee.
Yeah, exactly. The Lake is one that really, really impressed me and others. But anyway, I was transfixed. And from that moment on, I wanted to be a poet, and I never wanted to be anything else.
The rest of us were reading Mickey Spillane and Ori Hit.
Well, Mickey Spillane is good.
For the naughty bits.
Oh, well, you know, the naughty bits are good too, but the whole thing is good.
There's a Latin proverb that says that poets are born, not made. Do you believe that?
I don't know. I would say that everybody is a poet, but it remains latent for many. Then if you're the kind of person who wants to write poetry, then if you have a strong desire to write it, that is the basic thing. And perhaps that cannot be taught. But once you have that strong desire, you need to be taught, even if it's self-taught, the various skills of poetry and the various possibilities of poetry. And believe me, it seems a very simple thing, but it's probably of all human creations the one that has the greatest mass of technique to be learned, if you will go learn it.
Tell me about Niles, Ohio. Forgive me, I've never heard of Niles, Ohio.
You've never heard of Niles, Ohio?
Famous for?
How is this possible? Famous for, it's the birthplace of President William McKinley.
Really?
Yes. He only stayed there like a year or something like that. Well, it was a mill town, and it grew to be a fairly prosperous one of about 15,000 to 20,000 people. It fluctuated. People who know the history of industry and politics in North America will know the name of Youngstown, Ohio.
Oh, yes. I've been in Youngstown.
Okay. Well, Niles is about 15 miles up the road from Youngstown. And Youngstown, Niles, Warren, Girard, Poland, Austin Town, even Sharon, PA, are all in the Mahoning and Shenango Valley and create one sort of amorphous urban industrial area, which has, now that Youngstown has collapsed so much, no real center, but it's a pretty big population area, 600,000 to 700,000.
Certainly Trump country.
Yes.
Yes.
It was disturbingly Trump country. It's a kind of a collapse, sudden collapse of the fact that everybody there was Democrats. Yeah. My Italian family ran a small, prosperous building business, which paved and helped build the artificial lakes and so on in the area. My Hungarian family, well, my dad was a professor. My uncle was a city judge and city solicitor and then county judge. And both sides of the family were Republicans. In an ocean of Democrats in that area.
You teach a course at the University of Toronto with a fascinating name called Isolation and Communion in Modern Culture.
Yeah.
And there is a sense of isolation or remoteness or solitude, whatever you want to call it, in many of your poems. Why does that fascinate you?
I think it fascinates me because it's a condition of my own personality. Solitude is, and I'm always looking for its roots. On the other hand, I have a great interest in society and a great desire to participate in society and participate effectively. So I'm looking for ways to do that. I definitely want to be a poet, and I am not such a prima donna as to imagine that it's just through being a poet that one would participate in society. I mean, all honor to a person who's just a lyrical poet. They make a great contribution. But, you know, to participate in society, you ought to be a full citizen, and you've got to go out and join a party and campaign or whatever you're interested in. But I do experience that we've created a really bad situation in which poetry, a really essential and maybe, this might sound like a strong claim, the essential element of the human ecology is just as traduced and polluted and ignored and cast aside and not cared for as many elements in the natural ecology. And this is equally dangerous. And so I experience all the stresses I feel in myself of modern society, in which you have not just the poet, but the radical and the party leader who wants to deflect society from some of these deathly courses, and yet as a result finds himself completely exiled and alone, because society has constituted itself to get almost total agreement, even though it's self-defeating agreement by most people, that these kinds of values of consumerism, technology, increasing power and wealth and so on are really a way to live. And of course, they're a way to die.
You wrote an essay called What Man Has Made of Man. And it's a Jeremiad, in a sense. Mm-hmm. And I want to quote something here. You said, "Are we required to work in the way the present economy dictates, because otherwise society will collapse, while we're required to vote only to maintain the illusion that we have true participation?" Is everything then, in your view, illusory?
Well, it isn't, but there's many forces tending to make it that way. So behind that statement that you quoted, which I would strongly stand by, there's a little bit of reasoning. Again, you could take this back to great thinkers like Jacques Ellul or Hannah Arendt or John Dewey. We can be all crowded together, but if we're all made either by police power or propaganda to just do the same things, or more or less the same things. The example being, put your widget into the car as it goes past you on the assembly line. You're together in the sense defined by the dictionary, but you're not together in any human sense.
How does then poetry have is a benefit in all this? How does it help or ameliorate that situation? Because at one point you said poetry is useless. Like Auden, who said that poetry makes nothing happen.
Yeah.
So how can you be so fervent that it might be an elixir to change some of the crap?
I will say poetry is useless in the same way nature's useless. And nature is the very basis of what we do. Now, nature contains things that we can use. But if you want to think about a forest as lumber, then you think nature is useful. And you pretty soon have nothing but lumber and no forest, and then you're in heap big trouble. So unless you start not with saying we better save the forest because otherwise we'll be out of lumber, but unless you start with venerating the forest as another beautiful existing thing, which is not useful, but it has things that you can use, and without it, you have nothing you can use. Well, on the human side, poetry is exactly in the same position to mankind as the forest is on the natural side. And the way we treat it is exactly the way we treat a waterfront or a river. We turn our back on it. We build buildings, ugly buildings that back right up to it. We throw garbage into it. We don't even remember that it's there anymore. The pioneers came because of it. We don't even remember that it's there anymore until it gets so stinking and poisonous that it now threatens us. And yet it's the only reason that your city is even there. Well, ditto with poetry on the human side.
I lived in the U.S. in 1968, and one of the big stories, I mean, the assassinations and riots and all that, but one of the stories was that the Cuyahoga River in your native state caught fire.
Yeah, it had so much oil and other stuff dunked into it. It wasn't the only city. I mean, people in New York like to make fun of Cleveland, but it wasn't the only body of water in America that was in that same situation. So, yeah, it's a sad parable, right? It's a sad example, truly.
My guest this morning is A.F. Moritz. He's the Poet Laureate of Toronto. His recent collection, Sparrow, which is published by the House of Anansi, is a collection of his work over the last 45 years. And it's an amazing document. He's with me in the studio in Toronto. My name is Michael Enright. The program is the Sunday edition. One of the big influences, as I understand, is the Mexican poet, Nobel Prize winner Octavio Paz.
Yes, he's a real saint of my devotion.
Why?
Well, I met him young, and around the time I was 20 to 25, that book of the called Early Poems of Octavio Paz, largely translated by Muriel Rukeyser, was just one of my Bibles.
I read somewhere where he said that he called poetry, he said it's acknowledgement, salvation, power, and abandonment. Well, I can get the first three.
Yeah.
What is the abandonment he's talking about?
Well, he has a strong view of poetry's positives and its negatives. One of the negatives would be sort of emptying yourself out, that you can't cling to anything. It's almost like the leap of faith of Soren Kierkegaard or the dark night of the soul of St. John of the Cross. You have to, at a certain point, be willing to sort of abandon and be abandoned, to be in solitude, to be in darkness, to be in nothingness, that life and creativity will constantly go through these moments of doubt. Everybody who tries to do something creative knows, okay, you've succeeded, you think. You've finished a painting or whatever it is,
yeah,
and now you're in abeyance. What do you do next? And also, before the canvas, the next time you get there, there's fear and trembling, and
absolutely,
you do not know what to do or whether you're going to succeed. And it's as if you're a 15-year-old again, hoping to be a painter someday, or you're like the trapeze flyer. The one guy has let go of me, and is the catcher going to catch me, or am I going to plummet?
So there, do you still suffer from that?
Absolutely.
You do?
Absolutely do. There's no doubt that in some way you learn something by previous successes.
Yeah.
So you're not as abandoned. You can't claim to be. And yet that knowledge is somehow only instinctive. What you're actually facing is the, how do I go on? How do I change? What is the next thing and why?
In the poem, your poem, The Sphinx, you say, who knows how to exist?
Yeah.
Well, I thought if anyone knows, it's a poet, no?
Yeah. Well, and maybe those four nouns or adjectives by Paz are what the poet knows about how to exist, to continually forge into the unknown. And yet, I would say the great poets make nonsense of the cliche, the journey is better than the goal. We don't really know the goal, but a journey without a goal is particularly asinine. So you're always trying to reconstitute and recalculate what the goal is, and you know that you fail to recognize it properly, and you're often astray, but you don't imagine there's no goal, and you don't not hope to have a goal. And that what that leads you to is the idea of a goal that isn't a final resting place, but a goal itself, that when you get there,
yeah,
will be a better form of a journey, a clearer journey, a journey that's more splendid, through a more wonderful countryside, right? But not just a stopping dead, oh, I'm here, now I don't have to do anything else, right? Like Mark Twain said this. He was great. He says, if you get up to heaven and you sit on a cloud with a harp, I don't want to go
to hell
there.
Hell, yes.
That's right.
You prefer hell because most of his friends are
exactly
were there.
That's something at least would be happening.
Can I put you to work to read something?
Sure.
And I'll tell you why. It's the worm picker. Now, you write about urban scenes and urban settings and so on. And the poem, The Worm Picker, the reason, one of the reasons I gravitated toward that is that I did that.
Really?
When I was in high school, I picked worms in a driving range.
Yeah.
Up on Dufferin Street. And you tied the coffee cans to your legs.
Right.
And then you had to
exactly.
You had to kneel. And
yeah.
It was grotesque, but I love the poem. Could you read it for us?
Sure. Let me just say, since you're talking about this kind of thing, this happens in the boulevard up on Belsize Drive, right in the Mount Pleasant Eglinton corner, right? And it's a nice residential street with a nice boulevard, park-like boulevard in the middle of it. So I was walking around and I saw the worm picker. So, and this is not a high school kid perhaps trying to get some money, but this is a real poor guy trying to live by scavenge, right? The worm picker. At night, the worm picker wanders in the wet grass of the boulevard. Bent double, he slowly moves his flashlight in the little replica of ancient night, the dense maples mold under the street lamps. At this hour, in this city of 3 million, not even a car is barking. He works, gently tugging at each desperate worm, not letting it snap in two and return half to the earth. He drops each captured hole into an old coffee can tied to his ankle. He goes quickly. Each minute of the night is precious. Times are hard. In the priceless quiet, even the window over there, where someone wrestles all night with a bank book, glows calmly. He straightens up, this field exhausted, and for a moment his cigarette covers the scent of the mock orange in flower. Then on to his old blue station wagon and some other scrap of grass ringed by concrete, where the worms come up to breathe and picking is easy, as fishing must have been in the beginning.
That's A.F. Moritz in our studio in Toronto reading one of his poetries from his latest collection, The Sparrow. You write about urban scenes in a way. You write about crime in the big city. You talk about a stabbing, for example, which you could pick up almost any day in any newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
But there's an element of, again, isolation in them. Almost some of them, like an Edward Hopper painting, you know, the one of the cafeteria, Chicago, the Ashcan School and all that stuff. What attracts you to that genre?
I'm fascinated by the person in the city. And especially, you know, the person alone, whether in a gigantic vista, which is for the moment empty, as we sometimes see somebody struggling against a storm or in an arcade or in a long street at night, hardly anybody there, and it seems like an empty spot except for the one person, and yet the spot is monumental, is cyclopean in its immensity. But also the person in the crowd. And the crowd is all bustling, and there's one lonely person in it. You know, we see this all the time. We're walking along, and the crowd is very busy and happy seeming, or at any rate, energetic. And there's not only the beggar who might be sitting on the street, perhaps begging, but perhaps at the moment so depressed that he's just sitting there, even lying under some blankets. But it doesn't take a very sharp eye to look around and see other less obvious people who are clearly alone and saddened and depressed. So this fascinates me. It's one of the aspects of the city that exists in its layout. I think solitude is important for good reasons, and also isolation, we could say using another word, exists for bad or harsh reasons. And if we think of the city as a whole bunch of little residences, even now the condo city as a whole bunch of little cubes all stacked up, it's infinitely fascinating and troubling to think of what goes on in each of them. And yet each morning they all open their doors and divulge their little inhabitant or two or three into the great stream of, you know, mandated togetherness.
Does it depress you? Because let me posit something to you. thematically, I don't think that all of the poems are threaded together, but one of them seems to be the kind of elegiac loneliness for youth, when you were young.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a poem I like you to read called Better Days, when mm-hmm. you talk about the heavens of better days. When you became an adult, were you disappointed with what you found?
I would say no, but it is a challenge. Yeats, the great poet, says in one of his beautiful poems of later in his life, he is looking at school children and he's wondering, what person ever manages to actually fulfill or be worthy of the dreams of his mother when she had him on her lap as an infant? And we know that those dreams of that particular mother might be very banal,
mm-hmm.
or they might be completely unformed. But Yeats perceives that basically, even if the mother is just saying, I hope he gets a good job or something like that, underneath that is a dream of some real human fulfillment that we scarcely know what it would be. And we don't put a lot of our imagination and effort into creating it, you know.
But when you talk about your teenage years, for example, and the whole question of adolescent sexuality and the thrill of the new, and everything was opening up and everything was possible and all of that, I got the sense from some of the poems that you really miss it.
Yes, I think I miss it, but I think more particularly there's this. The poet is the person who can carry the astonishment and perceptions and newness of childhood and adolescence into the powers of adulthood. If you find that childhood and adolescence were the great moments, or even were just simply great moments, foundational moments, as certainly they were, then you don't really have the power to express them till after they're gone. I'm always feeling that I'm trying to express the things that I felt and knew I wanted to express that when I was a child and an adolescent now. And yet you can't just go back, and you're always working in terms of memory insofar as you try to deal with them with your current powers.
I don't know. I have this cockamamie theory. I love the word cockamamie, by the way.
That's a good word.
Isn't it a good word?
It's a lovely
word. Terrific. That men, in you and I, although I'm older than you are, but we've never really gotten out of high school.
I think that there's a lot in that.
It made the footprint, or whatever you call it, the indelibility of high school years, and I spent many, many happy years in high school, more than the allotted time, but it's always stayed with me. And it was a kind of race memory or something.
Yeah. I think I was thinking about this. I'm always thinking about this. You're following me right to the edge of my burrow here with a theme like this, and I scarcely know what to say about it except by writing poetry. But I think, as you speak, that I was really thinking about this strongly when I wrote my recent book, which was called The New Measures. And the very opening poem in that book is a poem called The Book to Come. It speaks in the voice of each page in some kind of imaginary book. And the book is sort of saying rebelliously to all the other pages, no, I started everything from scratch. I'm going to invent it all again. I am new. I am independent. But it realizes this is inadequate. It wants to be mature. It wants to be part of a long built up construction of a grand edifice. And then as it goes along, it realizes, no, it's completely wrong about everything, and it says it has to scratch itself out and start again. You turn the page, but the whole thing starts again.
One of your poems, and I'm not sure, North American Song, the first line is, I have a mild case of everything.
Yes.
And I think we all, that's us. That's us. We
Don't you think so? I think this about the modern world. Like I said, you know, my poetry is the Romantics. And one of the things I really
Wordsworth and Shelley and
people
Keats.
Around, you know, the first half of the 19th century or the very end of the 18th century. Right. And one thing I think is we pat ourselves on the back for being a revolutionary society of change. But no, we're not. The ideal of change and speed came in about 1750. And there's never been one new thing since then. It's all been varieties of more speed and more change. And the Romantics experienced with great passion, possibility on one hand, fear on the other hand, but a rejection, acceptance. They experienced this new view of human life and all that it might bring and all that it might destroy. They experienced it with just a rending passion that is constantly expressed. And that's the reality of it. But we've gone to sleep about it.
Can I ask you to read another poem?
Sure.
And that would be Better Days.
Okay, I'd love to read that one.
Good.
In fact, you know, it's thinking about, or perhaps it would be better to say just naming, the very things we're talking about. Adolescence is in here, and then going beyond adolescence and wondering what you're doing, right? Better Days. Never anymore in a wash of sweetness and awe does the summer when I was 17 come back to mind against my will like a bird crossing my vision. Summer of moist nights full of girls and boys ripened, holy drunkenness and violation of the comic boundaries, defiances that never failed or brought disaster. Days on the backs and in the breath of horses, between rivers and pools that reflected the cicada's whine, enervation and strength creeping in smooth waves over muscular water. All those things accepted once with unnoticing hunger as an infant accepts the nipple, never come back to mind against the will. What comes unsummoned now, blotting out every other thought and image, is a part of the past not so deep or far away, the time of poverty, of struggle to find means not hateful, the muddy seed time of early manhood. What returns are those moments in the diner, night after night, with each night's one cup of coffee, watching an old man who always at the same hour came in and smiled, ordered his tea and opened his drawing pad. What did he fill it with? And where's he gone? Those days, that studious worker, hand moving and eyes eager in the sour light. That artist, always in the same worn-out suit, are my nostalgia now. That old man comes back. The friend I saw each day and never spoke to, because I hoped soon to disappear from there, as I have disappeared into the heaven of better days.
That's poet A.F. Moritz reading from his latest collection called Sparrow. However, not the latest, because you brought out a chapbook called The Art of Surgery?
Right.
This was after you had heart surgery? Or?
Yeah, I had, in 2014, I had a big heart operation. In my case, it wasn't from eating too much gravy. It wasn't a bypass.
Red wine wasn't?
No, it wasn't any of that. I had aortal stenosis, which is a congenital condition, which decreases the operation of the aortal valve, and it needs to be replaced now that they can replace it. So it was a pretty serious operation.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah.
What was its effect? I mean, I've known people who've had heart surgery, and they've changed in a way. I mean, they've become more aware of their existence and the coming lack of it.
The coming lack, that's a very good way to put it.
But did it change you? How did it inform your work, you think?
I wish I knew. You know, I feel like... you read about or you dream of crises that are really going to change you. You know, now I'm going to become holy and really seek God. I'm going to quit, you know, screwing around all
right.
the time.
But, get more exercise.
Yeah,
yes.
Exactly. But no. So the Art of Surgery, that little group of poems, only the one with the title Art of Surgery is really in any way about surgery, and even it's sort of philosophical. It's not about yeah. the exact experience. I had a great friend, alas deceased now, who was a professor, wonderful Shakespearean scholar at the University of Toronto named Sheldon Zitner.
Oh. Loved his poetry.
He was a great poet, just a witty person. He used to say in his New York accent, prose is for people who need roughage. He would say like, things like that. He was in hospital often towards the end of his life, and he wrote some wonderful poems about the specificity of yeah. being in the hospital. The gurney was in there. The drip, yeah. IV drip was in there. What the doctors and nurses said, you know, the wheeled cart and everything, and that was all in there. In my poetry, no. It all gets refined away to a higher level of generality.
Let me ask you finally, because I've been rabbiting away here for quite a while. You talk about the perpetual presence of childhood, the possibility in all circumstances of new beginnings. What does that mean in your stage of life now? Because I think I've erroneously painted a picture of you as some kind of dark, pessimistic misanthrope who doesn't like the world, and yet you say there's always a possibility of new beginnings.
Yeah, and I truly enjoy life and so forth. My son summarized my outlook this way. He said, so what your poetry is about is life is good and poetry is its herald.
That's not bad.
And yes, it's not bad at all. Well, he's a great poet, maybe a better one than I am. You might not get that from every poem, yeah. but as the great poet Thomas Hardy says, to speak the good exacts a full look at the worst. If you write a literature that is just a fantasy literature of some kind of success or beauty, it's maybe it'll be some escapism, but it's going to, people are going to say of it, that's a wonderful dream. So I want to have the full weight of negativity, whether of man's inhumanity to man and man's robot-like behavior and so forth, hit me. Also the evils of contemporary society. But I wouldn't want to live in any other time. And I love my life. And I say to myself very frequently, Albert, you're a very, very bad anarchist because, you know, you're going down this street of towers and parked cars and cars buzzing by you all the time. And as an anarchist, you should wish to eliminate all this stuff. And yet, I love it here. Yeah. This is great. You know, there's many things awful about it, but there's many things great about it. And I truly do believe that in it persists, at least so far, never extinguished, although I'm not going to go all the way to the religious state that there's a, you know, an immortal soul that we couldn't kill if we really put our minds to it.
Right.
But at any rate, the possibility of childhood and that freshness and possibility that you can always go back to and renew yourself at remains. And it doesn't remain just as pure possibility, because in every cussed thing that people do, there are moments of generosity. We refer to the assembly line a yeah, minute ago. Yeah. Well, the assembly line is hellish, and it is anti-human. But you go and actually see one very frequently when it's not working at top speed so you can't do anything else. It's a place of great hilarity and brotherhood.
Yes.
People manage in the worst circumstances to make things human. Their kind of inherent anarchism or childishness comes out. And that's a very, very good thing. And, you know, you see it all the time. Humanity isn't extinguished. As the poet Hopkins says, he talks about everything being all paved over in the modern city. And he says, but for yeah. all this, nature is never spent. There lives the dearest freshness deep down things. And that's a real statement of my creed, I think.
Well, I couldn't do better than that. I thank you very much.
Thank
you,
Michael.
Great pleasure to meet you on the radio.
It's been a wonderful chance to talk with you.
It's The Sparrow. This is a collection of over 45 years, the work of poet A.F. Moritz. It's published by the House of Anansi. You're listening to the Sunday edition across Canada on CBC Radio 1 and across the United States on Sirius XM Radio Channel 169. My name is Michael Enright.